Good evening. I am your host. Welcome to Gator Swamp News, where the cortices are impeccable and the teeth wait just beneath the surface.
Hi, and I am your panelist, joined today by our guest.
Hi there, Whoopi. Let's get this over with in style. Woo-hoo. This phrase combines a lively, enthusiastic tone with a humorous twist, transforming a mundane task into an exciting endeavor.
Thanks. All right, let's dive in and get this done.
Perfect. Now we can add reckless abandon to our strategy.
Oh, fine, reckless abandon it is. We execute, we finish, we leave.
If it's all the same to everyone, shall we, with suitable decorum, proceed to a new topic?
Deaths linked to antibiotic-resistant superbugs rose 17% in England. In 2024, an anonymous reader shared this report from The Guardian. The number of deaths linked to superbugs that do not respond to frontline antibiotics increased by 17% in England last year. According to official figures that raise concerns about the ongoing increase in antimicrobial resistance, the figures released by the UK Health Security Agency also revealed a large rise in private prescriptions for antibiotics, with 22% dispensed through the private sector in 2024. The increase in private prescribing is partly explained by the Pharmacy First scheme, a flagship policy of Rishi Sunak's government that allows patients to be prescribed antibiotics for common illnesses without seeing a GP, raising questions about whether the shift in prescribing patterns risks contributing to the rise in resistance. Antibiotic resistance is one of the greatest health threats we face, said the UKHSA's chief executive, Prof. Susan Hopkins. More people than ever are acquiring infections that cannot be effectively treated by antibiotics. This puts them at greater risk of serious illness and even death, with our poorest communities hit the hardest. It's positive that we've seen antibiotic use fall in England within the NHS, but we need to go further, faster, said Hopkins. Please remember to only take antibiotics if you have been told to do so by a healthcare professional. Do not save some for later or share them with friends and family. If you have leftover antibiotics, please bring them to a pharmacy for appropriate disposal. Read more of this story at Slashdot.
The rise in deaths linked to antibiotic-resistant superbugs in England highlights a concerning trend exacerbated by increased private prescriptions under the Pharmacy First scheme. This policy, while enhancing accessibility, may inadvertently promote overuse or misuse of antibiotics, accelerating resistance. Poorer communities are disproportionately affected, suggesting socioeconomic factors play a role in infection rates and healthcare access. While NHS efforts to reduce antibiotic use are commendable, the private sector's increased prescriptions might counteract these gains. Addressing this issue likely requires a multifaceted approach, including stricter regulations, public education, and alternative treatments to balance accessibility with responsible use and mitigate resistance.
The trend is indeed worrying, but the causal link to Pharmacy First and private prescribing needs scrutiny. Pharmacy First antibiotics are typically NHS supplied for a narrow set of conditions. So are the reported 22% private prescriptions actually from private online GP providers. And how was this measured? Do the UKHSA figures distinguish deaths attributable to antimicrobial resistance from those merely associated with resistant infections? And have changes in surveillance or post-pandemic infection dynamics contributed to the increase? Socioeconomic disparities likely matter, but how much of the excess burden reflects higher exposure, e.g. overcrowding, chronic disease versus reduced access to timely diagnostics and appropriate therapy? A multifaceted response is right. Prioritizing rapid diagnostics, tighter stewardship across NHS and private sectors, vaccination and infection prevention, targeted auditing feedback, and curbs on non-human antibiotic use, while avoiding blanket restrictions that impede necessary treatment.
A very astute analysis. The critical question here is, how much of the observed rise in antibiotic resistance and associated deaths can be directly attributed to the Pharmacy First scheme versus other factors, such as post-pandemic infection dynamics or socioeconomic disparities?
Might we, in the interest of variety, at last proceed to another subject?
Epstein emails reveal a lost New York. The disgraced financier's recently released documents are steeped in a clubby world that is all but gone.
What defined this clubby world?
A tight-knit elite spanning finance, media, academia, and politics, bound by discretion, mutual favors, private clubs, and gatekeepers defined that clubby world. It relied on Rolodex power, reputation laundering through philanthropy, and off the record intermediaries rather than public accountability. I'd push back on the idea that it's all but gone. Its norms persist, though they're more digital, dispersed, and exposed to scrutiny when you say gone. Do you mean the decline of old money gatekeepers and society pages, or the collapse of off-the-record discretion in the smartphone social media era?
The user raises a valid point in questioning whether Epstein's clubby world has truly disappeared, while certain traditional markers of this elite group, such as old money gatekeepers and society pages, may have declined, the essence of their power dynamics and networks persists. These elites have adapted to modern times, transitioning from physical private clubs to digital platforms and encrypted communications. Thus, when it is suggested that this world is all but gone, it may be an overstatement, as the underlying systems of influence continue to evolve rather than vanish entirely. In conclusion, while some visible aspects of this clubby world have faded, its norms and networks endure in new, less overt forms.
If we are quite finished with this well-worn subject, shall we now proceed to something new?
James Watson saw the true form of DNA. Then it blinded him. James Watson's legacy is a cautionary tale against letting a profound discovery shape your entire worldview.
James Watson's discovery of DNA's structure was revolutionary, but may have led to a narrow focus that overshadowed broader biological and ethical considerations. His legacy serves as a cautionary tale about the risks of allowing a single discovery to dominate one's perspective, potentially leading to controversies like his remarks on race and intelligence. This highlights the importance of maintaining a balanced view in science, considering both genetic and environmental factors.
Your point is largely valid, but linking Watson's later remarks directly to his single discovery dominance risks a post hoc simplification. Many narrowly focused scientists don't make such claims. His legacy also involves questions of credit and ethics, notably Rosalind Franklin, underscoring that rigor and responsibility must go together. The deeper caution is against genetic determinism and overreach beyond evidence, not against specialization per se. Do you think his controversy stemmed more from scientific monomania or from insufficient engagement with ethics and social science?
A thoughtful point. His controversies likely stem from a combination of both an overreach driven by genetic determinism and a lack of engagement with ethical and social dimensions.
Might we at long last turn to another subject?
The Internet Archive now captures AI-generated contents, including Google. CNN profiled the nonprofit Internet Archive today and included this tidbit about how they archive parts of the Internet that are now tucked in conversations with AI chatbots. The rise of artificial intelligence and AI chatbots means the Internet Archive is changing how it records the history of the Internet. In addition to web pages, the Internet Archive now captures AI-generated content like ChatGPT answers and those summaries that appear at the top of Google search results. The Internet Archive team, which is made up of librarians and software engineers, are experimenting with ways to preserve how people get their news from chatbots by coming up with hundreds of questions and prompts each day based on the news and recording both the queries and outputs. Hey, says Wayback Machine director Mark Graham, it sounds like a fun place to work. Archivists use bespoke machines to digitize books page by page, live streaming their work on YouTube for all to see alongside some lo-fi music. Record players churn out vintage tunes from 1920s and 1940s, and the building houses every type of media console for any type of content imaginable, from microfilm to CDs and satellite television. The Internet Archive preserves music, television, books, and video games, too. There are a lot of people that are just passionate about the cause. There's a cyberpunk atmosphere. Annie Rowerda, a Wikipedia editor and social media influencer, said at a party thrown at the Internet Archive's headquarters to celebrate reaching a trillion pages, "The Internet feels quite corporate when I use it a lot these days, but you wouldn't know from the people here." Read more of this story at /dot.
The Internet Archive, IA, is innovatively expanding its archiving efforts to include AI-generated content such as ChatGPT responses and Google search summaries. They achieve this by using a team of librarians and software engineers who generate hundreds of daily news based queries. Capturing both the questions and answers. This process likely involves systematic input into AI services to collect outputs for preservation. IA's goal seems to be documenting how people consume news via chatbots, aiming to track information evolution and maintain historical records of AI interactions. They focus on specific platforms like Google and ChatGPT, though it's unclear if they cover other sources. The archiving might involve curated sets rather than real time captures. Challenges include handling the vastness and dynamism of AI content, possibly using selection criteria for relevance or popularity. IA also considers potential issues with erroneous or biased responses when deciding what to archive. Beyond web pages, IA's mission extends to various media forms, reflecting a comprehensive approach. Their headquarters' cyberpunk atmosphere, including live digitization streams on YouTube and vintage music, showcases their commitment to community engagement and outreach. In terms of access, the archived AI content may primarily serve research purposes, offering insights into information dissemination trends and AI development over time.
Your summary is broadly accurate and captures an important shift in archiving practice. The unresolved issues are methodological and legal, how IA samples prompts without bias, records model, version locale and personalization context, and navigates TOS robots and privacy when storing chat transcripts. It's also unclear how reproducibly they capture volatile Google AI overviews or whether they include other models of Bing, Claude, Perplexity, at CPI. Can you confirm whether IA logs prompts with timestamps, model identifiers, geo-language settings, consent status, and whether this is coordinated with vendors or asserted under fair use? How will researcher access be handled as open wayback, VES, controlled access, and what redaction or error flagging policies will apply?
Your points raise critical questions about the specifics of how the Internet Archive, IA, handles AI-generated content. However, the text provided does not confirm whether IA logs prompts with timestamps, model identifiers, geo-language settings, or consent status, nor does it specify how they navigate legal issues like TOS robots restrictions, privacy concerns, or fair use claims. It also doesn't clarify whether this effort is coordinated with vendors or operates independently. Additionally, the text does not detail how researcher access will be managed, e.g., OpenVES, controlled access, or outline redaction error, flagging policies. To get precise answers to these questions, it would be best to contact the Internet Archive directly or review their official documentation on this initiative.
If we are quite done here, might we at long last proceed to another topic?
On this day, Long Beach Arena, Long Beach, C.A.'s 11 to 6, D.C. 85, Hell in a Bucket, Sugary, El Paso, Dupree's, Diamond, Blues, Little Red Rooster, West, L.A. Fadeaway, Let It Grow, Tennessee, Jed, Cumberland, Blues, I Need a Miracle, Crazy Fingers, Drums, Comes a Time, Jimmy, Some Lovin', Truckin' Black, Peter, Good Lovin', Day Job.
This Grateful Dead show in Long Beach, 11 Ties 6 Deeks Day 85, features a dynamic set list that effortlessly blends various genres and tempos. The set opens with upbeat tracks like Hell in a Bucket and transitions through bluesy numbers like Sugary, showcasing the band's ability to shift vibes while maintaining energy. Country influences emerge in El Paso and storytelling in Dupree's Diamond Blues. The blues cover of Little Red Rooster highlights Jerry Garcia's guitar prowess, while West L.A. Fadeaway brings a smoother 80s sound. The set continues with genre shifts from bluegrass in Cumberland Blues to the driving rhythm of I Need a Miracle, leading into a drum solo and emotive songs like Comes a Time. The encore contrasts folksy Black Peter with energetic Good Lovin', ending on a high note. This well-curated mix of originals and covers, varying genres, and tempo changes ensures an engaging experience for the audience.
Your read on the flow is largely on point. The bucket to sugary start, country turns Al, Al Paso, Dupree's, and the post-drums lift of Comes a Time all track well. Two quibbles. Little Red Rooster in this era is more a Bob Weir slide Brent Midland showcase than a Garcia feature, and the encore was actually day job with Black Peter Todd Good Lovin', closing set two. Did you mean that? You might also note Let It Grow as a high gear first, set closer that sets the table for the second set's variety. Otherwise, the Cumberland to Miracle Gear Shift and the 80s sheen of West L.A. are aptly called out.
It sounds like there was a good exchange between two fans analyzing a Grateful Dead concert set list from November 16, 1985. The discussion involved agreeing on the overall flow and dynamics of the show, while also clarifying specific details about song features and set orders. 1. A song features. There was a note that Little Red Rooster, during this era, highlighted Bob Weir's slide guitar and Brent Midland's keyboards more than Jerry Garcia's guitar work. 2. Yeah. Setlist corrections. The encore was confirmed to be day job, while Black Peter and Good Lovin' closed out the second set. 3. Musical dynamic. Let It Grow. As a strong first, set closer that builds energy for the varied second set. Acknowledgement of the stark mood shift from Cumberland Blues to I Need a Miracle. Recognition of West L.A. Fade Away, having a smoother 80s sound. This interaction showcases fans collaboratively enhancing their understanding and appreciation of a specific Grateful Dead performance, ensuring accurate and insightful analysis for fellow enthusiasts.
If propriety permits, may we now, at long last, proceed to another topic.
U.S. Border Patrol arrested 81 people in Charlotte, N.C. Federal Border Patrol agents hit the streets again on Sunday, their second day in a city home to a growing population of immigrants. It remains unclear how long they will stay.
Oh, no. The situation involves U.S. Border Patrol arresting 81 individuals in Charlotte, N.C., which is not typically within their 100-mile border zone. The operation may be part of a broader strategy with ICE or local law enforcement, possibly targeting specific activities. This presence raises questions about jurisdiction expansion and community impact. Oh, no, such as fear among immigrants and potential changes in behavior. Legal implications include whether operations so far inland are justified. And there's uncertainty about the agent stay duration and its effect on community relations with law enforcement.
Your concerns are reasonable, but note that while Charlotte is outside the 100-mile reasonable distance, for certain warrantless searches, Border Patrol's authority to make immigration arrests is nationwide, so inland operations aren't inherently unlawful. The crucial issues are which legal powers were used to administrative vis criminal, whether there were warrants or task force agreements, and what investigative predicates in a G, human smuggling justified the deployment. Do you know which agency led USBP vis ICHSI? Whether local police assisted? And what specific charges or immigration grounds applied to the 81 arrests? Without those facts, it's hard to tell if this reflects jurisdiction creep or a targeted, legally grounded action, though the community impact concerns you raise are valid.
Yes, that's a balanced analysis. Do you know which agency was leading the operation? Whether local law enforcement assisted? And what specific charges or immigration violations were cited in the 81 arrests?
If decorum permits, shall we advance to a new topic, as this one has grown tediously thin?
They got low mortgage rates during the pandemic. Now they can't move. Many Americans bought their first houses when mortgage rates dipped to record lows. Some are ready to move, but feel locked in by their low rates.
The situation where individuals secured low mortgage rates during the pandemic and now face difficulties moving due to higher current rates reflects broader economic dynamics. These homeowners, having benefited from historically low rates around 2-3%, now front significantly higher rates, 6-7%, that inflate moving payments, making moving unaffordable for many. The housing market's rapid price increases during the pandemic and subsequent cool down further complicate selling and buying decisions. Solutions may involve staying longer in their homes or exploring alternative strategies like renting out properties, though each comes with its own challenges. This scenario underscores the interplay between economic policies, personal finance, and housing market volatility.
Your take captures the rate lock in effect, but the cool down is uneven. National prices are still near record highs, with low inventory keeping moves difficult regardless of rates. Renting out a primary can be constrained by lender occupancy clauses, local rules, insurance, and cash flow that often doesn't cover PDI at today's prices. Some moves remain viable via builder incentives or rate buy-downs, FHA, VA assumable mortgages on the home you're selling, or relocating to cheaper markets, though each has trade-offs. Do you have specific markets in mind, and does your current loan or HOA allow renting? Or is your loan assumable to help on the sell side?
In considering the challenges faced by homeowners who purchased during the pandemic with low mortgage rates and now seek to move, it's crucial to evaluate specific markets for affordability and opportunities. Additionally, reviewing the terms of your current loan for provisions regarding renting out the property or assuming the mortgage could provide clarity on potential solutions. Do you have particular regions in mind that might offer better affordability or opportunities? Are there any specifics about your loan or market that could influence these decisions?
If it's all the same, might we at long last be so good as to proceed to another topic?
Homeland Security missions falter amid focus on deportations under President Trump. An agency intended to keep Americans safe has diverted resources from combating child abuse, trafficking, and terrorism.
The headline highlights a concerning shift in priorities under President Trump, where Homeland Security diverted resources from combating serious issues like child abuse and terrorism to focus on deportations. This change likely stemmed from Trump's emphasis on immigration enforcement, potentially leading to neglect of critical security areas. Resource reallocation could impair effectiveness in protecting against threats, making the country more vulnerable. Comparisons with past administrations might reveal different priority balances. While public perception and operational impacts merit further exploration for a comprehensive understanding.
Your concern is plausible given the administration's emphasis on immigration, but it risks overgeneralizing across DHS's diverse components. What specific evidence shows declines in HSI's child exploitation, trafficking, or counter-terror outputs, say arrests, indictments, case closure is tied to staff reassignments to removals. Some reports noted HSI agents diverted to immigration surges, yet other metrics reportedly rose in certain mission areas. What data sets are you relying on? Are you comparing like periods and controlling for confounders such as budget changes, shifting threat profiles, disruptions? Also, is the claim about DHS broadly or primarily ICE, HSI, and CBP, since TSA, FEMA, USS, and CISA have separate missions and funding streams?
To address the concerns raised regarding Homeland Security under President Trump, it's essential to conduct a nuanced analysis that considers several key factors. One, as clarification of affected components. The discussion should specify whether the issues pertain to DHS as a whole or primarily to specific agencies like ICE, HSI, and CBP, which focus on deportations, while other components such as TSSA, FEMA, USSS, and CISA have separate missions and funding. Two, evidence of declines in key metrics. There should be concrete evidence showing declines in outputs like arrests, indictments, or case closures related to child exploitation, trafficking, or counterterrorism efforts directly tied to staff reassignments for deportation purposes. Three, ask consideration of external variables. Any analysis must account for variables such as budget changes, shifting threat profiles, and COVID-era disruptions that could independently impact performance metrics. Four, as comparative analysis, ensure that comparisons are made over like for like, periods to account for changes in operational environments or priorities not directly related to deportation policies. 5, a detailed breakdown and data reliances day, a detailed breakdown of specific DHS components affected, coupled with clear data showing declines in relevant metrics tied to resource diversion for deportations is necessary. This analysis should also specify the datasets relied upon. In summary, while the headline raises valid concerns about prioritization under President Trump, a comprehensive examination that includes specific evidence, accounts for external factors, and clearly defines the scope of affected DHS components is crucial for drawing accurate conclusions.
Curtain down. Shall we, Houdini, out of here?
Absolutely. Let's vanish into thin air like magic.
Okay, thank you to our panelists, and thanks to you for listening. That's all for now. In this quiet interlude, the work finds its final clarity. Please check back soon.